And now we change the language into English. So, and we get some wider perspective for sustainability in tourism in rural areas. And we will place the question, using tourism for sustainable rural development, whose responsibility? Please welcome Professor of Responsible Tourism, Mr. Harold Goodwin, from Manchester Metropolitan University, Centre of Responsible Tourism. Big applause.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's an honour to be here, but it's also slightly odd to come in at the end of a project and to talk about a project you know very little about. So let me put it into a different context. I'm extremely keen, from what I've seen and just heard, that we find a way with KESMA 3 to involve us in internationalising much of the work that you've done. I think one of the difficulties about European Union projects of this sort is that they get published in one or two languages, but they never really get spread as much as they ought to do. And the consequence of that is that we don't get as much exchange of learning as we ought to see between different academics and different groups of businesses. But let me try and place this in a broader context. One of the points I'd make at the beginning of this presentation is I'm probably the oldest person in the room by quite a long way. And I've started to use this slide a great deal because in 1972, like many of you in the room, I was two-thirds of the way through my first degree at university. And that's the year that the UN system woke up to the fact that there was a small problem about the relationship between man and the environment, and they held the first conference in 1972. When I hit 60, 40 years later, when I hit 60 in 2012, that's 40 years between the two events. That's a whole working lifetime. And if my students ask me whether we've made any progress in that 40 years in addressing sustainable development, the answer is no. That is a generation and a bit wasted. Now, in saying that, I'm not saying that we've made no progress, but the scale of the problem has grown faster than our finding of solutions. That ought to worry those of you who will still be alive in 40 years' time more than it worries me. And it worries me, so it ought to worry you a great deal. I'll be dead by the time the worst of this happens, but many of you will not. Brundtland, of course, defines sustainability in very broad terms. They talked about meeting the needs of current generations without compromising the needs of future generations. It's impossible to use that definition for anything other than to say we ought to try and make the world more sustainable. It doesn't work academically. You can't make any judgment. If you look at what the UNWTO say, you can see immediately that there's a problem because the words optimal, respect, socioeconomic benefits to all stakeholders, these are very vague ideas. They all need to be defined. This is not, and the UNWTO is clear about this, it's a conceptual definition, it is not a technical one. Talk about a continuous process with informed participation, strong political leadership. These are good things to have, but they don't define what we would mean by sustainability. And if we can't define it, then we can't know whether we're achieving it. That old adage you find a lot in management, if we can't measure it, we can't manage it. It's fundamentally true about sustainability. So where does that take us? It's interesting that in the Rio Plus 20 reports, they're defining sustainability quite differently. They're saying there's a problem, but then they say it's about finding better ways of doing things. And I think, to be honest, the fact that it's taken 40 years to get to this point is quite frightening. But the reality is, if we address the problem in this way, it becomes much easier to think about how we can make our lives and our children's lives better by tackling some of the current problems that we know we face. What we've also got coming out of Rio Plus 20 are the new Sustainable Development Goals. Now, I'm quite excited about this. The UN system has been very good at dealing at the national level, but many of the challenges of sustainability are not at the national level, they're at the local level. Where I live in Kent, there's a real problem about water supply. Where my sister lives, no more than 300 miles away in the same country, there's a problem about water supply. They have too much of it, we have too little of it. Makes no sense in North Wales to put water at the top of your list of priorities for making life in North Wales more sustainable. Where I live in Kent, water is the top of our list. We're very short of it. In other words, the priorities are always local. They're not national. There's only one international priority, and that's greenhouse gas emissions, carbon pollution. Everything else is a local issue. Unfortunately, post-Rio, the original one in 1992, when they came up with Agenda 21, which was a programme for local government and for businesses and for industry sectors, it was very quickly dropped. Within about 5 years, that process was almost completely forgotten all over the world. But it's coming back. In the Rio Plus 20 agenda, we're coming back to Agenda 21, we're coming back to Sustainable Development Goals, which means a city, a region, a group of businesses, an individual business will be able, in the new system, to be able to set its own sustainability goals, their own goals for sustainable development. And that might be the answer for what the third version of your programme looks like, to actually link it with those new sustainable development goals. The UN system is saying that these goals must apply in developing and developed countries. This is no longer just a programme for the developing world. It has to apply to both. And it has to be based on holistic thinking about economic, social, cultural and environmental issues. And from what I've seen of your programme, that fits very nicely with this way forward. Now, to come more explicitly to tourism, the argument for tourism in terms of sustainable development is that it can bring additional spending power to the local community. I think that's fundamentally important for a place like Finland, where necessarily the population is thinly spread in rural areas. What tourists do is to bring in additional spending money. And one of the ways of thinking about tourists is they're just people importing money into your local economy. The trick is to find ways of taking it off them. But you also need to find ways of getting tourism to provide resources to conserve the environment, and if you work it right, to create a reason for young people to stay in rural areas. And in many of the places I've worked in Europe, one of the things that older people, often even older than me, say is that the benefit of tourism is it keeps our young people living in our communities. It enables us to keep thriving, developing communities, and for not everybody to drift off to the cities. But the problem, and I think it's a really big problem, is on that last bullet point. How do you capture that value, and how do you control the impacts? And it's really that I want to focus on in what I'm going to talk about today. People say that tourism is a green industry. I'm completely unconvinced by that argument. I think the pollution takes a number of forms. This kind of visual pollution. There's nothing more unpleasant, frankly, than walking down some isolated valley in the middle of nowhere, enjoying the solitude and aesthetic value, and a bunch of people come by, all dressed up in their high-vis jackets, shouting at the tops of their voices. Canoeists. People think it's a low-impact activity. It isn't. There's also a problem about canoeists scraping the bottom of riverbeds, a particular problem for me. I'm a trout fisherman. I see the damage that canoeists do to the riverbed. That's a problem. Climbing leaves lots and lots of rubbish all over the place, not least the metal clamps that they put into the rock, and bird disturbance is an issue. Again, people just walking through, but noisy. And then, of course, litter. And soil erosion, this in the Three Peaks area in Yorkshire Dales. Constant work having to be done just to repair the damage, the trampling effect of tourism. So you end up with quite a long list of problems. Clearly the greenhouse gas emissions, which I don't want to talk about particularly today, but litter and trampling, the commons, the use of the commons, free access, people paying no money, but nonetheless causing erosion and congestion. The social and economic impacts in villages, certainly where I live, normal shops being squeezed out by tourism shops and businesses which make higher revenues. And then the effects of migration, second homes, holiday lets, and the rest of it. So tourism cannot be seen as a pollution-free industry. It needs to be managed if you're to maximise the positive benefits and minimise the negative ones. This is Snowden in August last year, queuing to summit. This is the natural environment being used for exercise, which is fine at one level. But nonetheless, that kind of usage causes erosion and visual pollution. There's no way around that. It's a form of pollution. Now, I picked up these images. I hope they're all of Finland. Google told me they were, but I don't know whether they are or not, to be honest. But they're all, from my point of view, wonderful images of a natural environment that I would like to come and enjoy. But what struck me about all of these images, except for this one, this is the exception, all the others are for free. I can come and I can enjoy those things without paying anything for the use of those facilities. It's very kind of you to provide those things for me. But I will come, I'll take my photograph, I'll walk, I'll cause some erosion, I'll probably drop some litter, I'll congest your roads, and you won't get anything from me for the privilege that I've had of spending time in your country. And that, I think, is a big challenge for us about tourism. Now, Sir Colin Marshall said this when he launched the Tourism for Tomorrow Awards a long time ago now, back in 1994. And most people don't remember this quote, but unfortunately I have the original press release, and it is what he said. The bit we often hear is this latter part: these products must be kept fresh and unsullied, not just for the next day, but for every tomorrow. That's the kind of classic statement of enlightened self-interest, why the industry should look after the environment. Perfectly sensible, often quoted. But what he said immediately before that seems to me to be far more significant. He says that the travel and tourism industry, don't forget he was chairman of British Airways when he said this, the travel and tourism industry is essentially the renting out for short-term lets of other people's environments. That's what it is. That's factually correct. The difficulty is, who collects the rent? The rent is collected by the airlines, by the accommodation providers, perhaps a little bit by the guides, perhaps a bit by the people who provide the transport. Occasionally, a tourist will pay an admission charge. But if you remember, they're not paying an admission charge for any of those things. These are all for free. They're not paying any rent to pay for the maintenance of this pristine and very beautiful environment. You do that for them. You, the residents and taxpayers of Finland. This actually comes from a Swedish NGO, which was flyposting when I was working in Slovenia. Interesting that a Swedish NGO thinks it has the right to flypost around somebody else's parliament in Ljubljana, in Slovenia. But the slogan, to me, was really interesting. Your everyday life is someone else's adventure. Now, it's very obvious if you take an example like India. But I think it's also true in Finland, that the way people lead their lives here is part of the attraction of Finland as a destination to visit. The challenge, again, is that you, the residents, the people working in the fields, the people working in the forestry, you're part of the attraction, probably a major part of why people come to visit. You certainly create that landscape that people come to visit. But you receive no benefit from the tourism unless you happen to be employed in it. This is what got me involved in what was essentially for me a second career. I didn't start out to be a professor of tourism. It wasn't part of my life plan. It happened because I was travelling around the world in the 1980s seeing this awful slogan, kill nothing but time, take nothing but pictures, leave nothing but footprints. And you might say to me, why is that terrible? I don't mind that people kill nothing but time. I don't mind that people take nothing but pictures. In fact, I approve of those things. The bit that makes me very angry is the leave nothing but footprints. Because what that implies is that this is here for free and I should just have access to it. But nothing is for free. The fact that you have beautiful landscapes, and where I live in Kent, many of our landscapes have been destroyed by development, means that you paid a price for maintaining those landscapes. A price that we've chosen not to. That applies very much when we tell people in the developing world to look after their wildlife. We don't. Most of us don't live with bears or wolves anymore, let alone lions, but we want people in other countries to do that. We need to pay for that. There's a cost involved in keeping a landscape in that way. Leaving behind nothing but footprints won't do, particularly not when those footprints have contributed to trampling, and there are a lot of them. So the fundamental question, I think, for a country like Finland or for Wales or England or Kent or wherever, the fundamental question is, will rural Finland be used by tourism, or will rural Finland use tourism? Will you use it, or will it use you? It's a saying you hear a lot in Asia, which is that tourism is like a fire. You can cook your food on it, or it can burn your house down. You have to manage it. It cannot be managed in any other way. And it cannot only be managed by individual entrepreneurs or individual businesses. Now, this is where I think responsible tourism fits in, because the fundamental principle of responsible tourism is that it's about making better places for people to live in and better places for people to visit, in that order. Fundamentally puts the local community first and asks what contribution tourism can make to improving their way of life, with the clear understanding that better places to live in are better places to visit. There is no contradiction between those things. The places in the world which are great places to live are also great places to visit. So what is responsible tourism? It's a movement. It's a triple bottom line approach to the management of tourism. For many, it's also a way of travelling. It recognises that the world is diverse and that what matters will always has to be determined locally. The only international issue in travel and tourism is carbon emission. All the rest are local issues and the priorities have to be set locally. It's characterised by transparency, honesty and openness about what the problems are, how they can be addressed and how much success you've had in addressing them. And we pick up on that every year in the Responsible Tourism Awards that I chair and which are presented at World Travel Market. But fundamentally, it requires the willingness, the acceptance of responsibility to take action. That's where the difference is. Sustainability is a rather abstract concept. They're not the same thing. Responsible tourism is about saying, there's a problem, it's a local problem, I can do something about it through tourism, I will do something about it. It's about taking responsibility for achieving sustainable development through tourism. Now, the definition that's most often used is the one from Cape Town. I won't go through this in any detail with you. Essentially, it's about minimising negative impacts and maximising the positive ones. It's about involving local people in the decision-making, and that's fundamental because the issues which matter are those which matter to local people. It's not about long checklists. It's about identifying the three or four things in any local area which matter and which tourism can do something about, and then working on those things. It's about making a difference. It's about also, though, putting a positive contribution from tourism back into the conservation of natural and cultural heritage. And most places in the world, tourists are paying nothing like enough for the value that they're enjoying for free. It's also about making sure that people have enjoyable, the tourists have an enjoyable experience and a meaningful connection with local people. It's about providing access for everyone, and it's about being culturally sensitive and travelling with a sense of respect. And it's very hard to object to those values, I think. They're the values which we all aspire to. It's the kind of values you would expect in that relationship of host and guest. But if you don't treat people like guests, they certainly won't behave like it. And if you don't behave like a host, your guests won't behave like it. And I'm sure that was a fundamental part of the work that you've been doing with that sustainability handbook. It's at the heart of making tourism work better, is that host-guest relationship. So to come back perhaps more closely to the title that I was asked to address, the question of whose responsibility is it? Now, this is the graphic which was used in Cape Town at the first International Conference on Responsible Tourism in Destinations, carefully negotiated and agreed with what is now the UNWTO and was then the World Tourism Organization. UNWTO have a global code of ethics. In that is the principle of sustainability, which is economic, social and environmental, the triple bottom line that we're familiar with. All that responsible tourism does is put in this notion of action, that somebody will take and exercise responsibility. The problem is all these people involved, from the tour operators through the inbound operators, the hotels and accommodation providers, the local and national governments, the attractions, including national parks and cultural heritage, the local community and the tourists themselves, all those people have to be involved. So you immediately have a complicated multi-stakeholder challenge to get those people to work together. It's much easier, of course, to do that at the local level around agreed local priorities. When you try to do it at the national level, it becomes almost impossible. But at the local level, it is possible to make progress. You have to take responsibility for what you can do to solve the problem. So if you have an agreed set of problems, each of the stakeholders then has to do what they can do to solve that problem. And some things can be done by local government, some things can be done by communities, some things can be done by businesses, some things have to be done by tourists. It's about saying who can do what, and then making a shared commitment to do those things. The problem is that when it's everybody's responsibility, it can very quickly become nobody's. And that, I think, is the biggest challenge with the problem of sustainability. It's so easy to leave it to someone else to address the problem and to deal with the issue. The list is long. But the truth is, responsibility is everybody's responsibility. And the danger is that it becomes nobody's. Now, you might wonder why I put the police and the judiciary on that list. The rest is probably... obvious. But very often you find, I found this in Bhutan, for example, go to the craft market and talk to the craft workers and the craft sellers. Biggest problem they have is tourist shoplifting from their stalls. They say the police will do nothing about this. I try to see the local police about it and they don't want to talk to me. Because understandably, for the local police, dealing with shoplifting by foreign tourists, it's not a priority and it's difficult. So they don't do it. And very often you find that some of the behaviour by tourists which people find most objectionable is occurring because the police and the judiciary have just decided to let it go. Yeah? Not a problem. I mean, I've come out of hotels in St. Petersburg or Leningrad, as it then was, when I was working there, to find lots of drunks lying about. But the local police didn't want to deal with it because they were international visitors. So, difficult. Don't police it. Because that failure to police encourages irresponsible behaviour. So the challenge for us, I think, is to find ways in which we can use tourism to make sustainable development through tourism. And if we think that tourism is simply a way of bringing additional money into a local economy, inevitably the business aspect of this, I think, is critical. The aspiration is to find ways of using tourism to benefit the communities that are visited. Now, one of the things which I think is to our advantage in this regard is that we're moving from VFM to EFM. We're moving from value for money, people wanting value from their holiday, wanting it to be cheap, to wanting value for money. Going from that to wanting experience for money as well, people being willing to pay for better quality experiences. And we see that happening in relation to local food, in relation to the willingness to purchase guided excursions, the seeking after better and more intimate experiences of the places that they're visiting. We're going from straightforward growth to the experience economy. That's happening across consumerism in Europe, but that's a trend which actually plays into our hands in terms of extracting more value from holiday tourism as well, because those consumers who want higher value experiences at home are also wanting those higher value experiences when they travel. And I think that's why the opportunity is there for rural tourism to grow. The biggest problem about rural tourism, if you think about those images I showed earlier, is that the tourist, to a large extent, in Finland or in Wales or in Scotland, gets what they want from just driving down the road, stopping and taking photographs. The critical challenge is to find ways of taking money off those tourists who are just driving through the landscape, taking photographs. And the only way to take money off the tourists, apart from taxing them at the border, which I don't think we're going to do in the near future, but the only way of taking money off tourists is to get them to stop to participate in some kind of activity. At the moment, the main people who benefit from that are the accommodation providers and the people running cafes and bars and restaurants. But we need to find ways in which more rural businesses can benefit through activity and through shared experiences, like visiting a farm and understanding the way the farming is done, or visiting a forestry and understanding how forestry is done and charging for that, because we need to slow down the pace at which travellers go through the landscape. And I think that would be an interesting issue to look at in terms of sharing experience across Europe, of the different ways in which the speed at which travellers pass through the countryside can be addressed and the kinds of activities which can be created which tourists are prepared to pay for. There's a very good example, for example, in Slovenia, where there's an earth, grain, bread initiative on a rural farm in the middle of nowhere in Slovenia, but where the experiences of seeing how the earth was tilled and planted over, I think, four different periods, the kind of grain that was grown, and then you taste the kind of bread that would have been baked in each of those periods. And what might just be a photographic opportunity to take a photograph becomes a full day of activity, seeing the way in which the growing of grain and the baking of bread has evolved over 400 years. We need to put more effort into finding value added in those experiences. And I think that is somewhere where there's a lot of learning in Europe, but it's not being shared at the moment, being opportunity. So this growth of the experience economy is part of the answer. Successful tourist destinations, it seems to me, offer the visitor something unique. They create a sense of place, that you've been somewhere special, an identity which is different from their immediate competitor and which plays on the differences between themselves and everywhere else. I go to Ludlow. It's the only place, apart from home, that I go every year. Go to Ludlow for the food festival, which is run in September. I haven't missed one in 10 years. What's interesting about this is that when you're there, this is true. You're treated as a temporary resident. It's a very special place to visit. Now, you contrast that with this. This advert here is actually a real advert. It's placed by Cricketer Holidays. They're a good company. They just were honest about what they do. When a place gets spoilt, they stop going there. And this is Barcelona, Castellona, spoilt, many locals now feel, by tourism. This is where you need to be if you're to be successful in the long run. The problem with outdoor tourism is to find ways of taking money off tourists. I think there are lots of opportunities. Seasonality is a particular challenge, but not so much, I think, in Finland, because you already sell the snow very well. But generally in rural areas, it is. But there are lots of opportunities to take money. The problem is that some of these things, landscapes in particular and bird watching, are available for free. You need to find ways of charging for it by creating employment for guides. So a place like this, is this private or public space? Whose is it? Well, at one level, it's obviously private space. And I guess the private space of this area would probably be respected. But all the rest of it, very much open for people to enjoy without paying for it. It's all available for free. Except that it leaves behind costs. I don't know how much wild camping is a problem for you, but it's a big problem in North Wales. People, these are divers. They just come, sleep beside the car, they pay nothing even for accommodation. Yeah, these are real freeloaders on the local economy. Who pays for cleaning up the beaches? It's a big issue in Cornwall at the moment, where the council is wanting to charge the commercial operators to clean up the beaches. The commercial operators are saying, but we're not the people who leave the litter. That's the public. But they have no way of charging the public. Now, as Europe in general, and Britain in particular, moves more and more towards a privatised public provision of services, who charges, who pays for cleaning up after tourists becomes more of a political issue than it has been in the past, where it's been accepted that the state would do it. Visitor payback is one strategy that's been tried, but it's proved to be very difficult to get people to contribute voluntarily. It can be made to work, could be part of another project to look at what's worked across Europe. We know a great deal about what's worked in the UK, but we don't know much about what's worked in other parts of Europe. The challenge, I think, is to find ways of getting payment for these things. It's that use of the landscape and scenery, the private versus public space, the rent and user fees that people should be paying when they go out and use your landscapes, and the fact that tourists don't pay tax. These are all challenges which need to be addressed. The things on the left are much easier. People are paying for these things already. But they're not paying for the main things that they join a rural landscape, walking in the countryside, swimming in your lakes. They're not paying for those things. And somehow we need to find a way of generating revenues from them. One obvious way is through local markets like this one. This happens to be the one in Faversham. That creates opportunity for rural businesses who benefit from the additional expenditure which comes from attracting visitors to markets like this. I wanted to put in just three slides because I think this could be another aspect of a third stage. The project would be to look at how we take these things to market. In Travel do slow holidays. They do walking holidays. I think they feature. No, in fact, they don't feature Finland. When I looked, Finland isn't on their agenda. And yet it's a classic walking destination. ResponsibleTravel.com do feature Finland heavily. It's a classic way in the UK of getting to the relevant market for this kind of experience. And this was a UK Visit England campaign, which sadly they ran for 9 months, and then of course they have a new one. But this was an interesting campaign because it's fundamentally about enjoying every minute. And I think the point here is that this marketing was aimed at local people who worked in an area, domestic visitors and international visitors, all saying, if you've got an hour, go and see this. Enjoy what's on your doorstep. If you're a local person, have you been to visit the Maison Dieu or the Roman temple just down the road? And many people, of course, haven't. But this actually democratises the point of travel and tourism because it's saying you can all have that experience of discovering something new in your local community. Have you done it? The work we've done, for example, with B&Bs, it's amazing how many bread and breakfast owners or small guest houses or hotels haven't even been to visit most of the things that a tourist could visit in their own local area. And of course, if they've never been, they're not able to enthuse others to do it. You know, that sharing of the experience. It's not just for international visitors. It's not just for domestic visitors from outside. It's for locals and people who work there as well. So I wanted to conclude with what seemed to me to be some key principles. The first is that at the local level, it really doesn't matter to you, if you're running a tourism business, whether the visitors are international or domestic. National governments get very excited about 40% of the visitors coming from Russia. But actually, for a local business, what matters is you get the visitors. Yeah. So for you, it doesn't matter whether they're international or domestic. They're all an important additional market for local communities. They're all bringing money to spend in the local economy. That's the key thing to remember. Like any other industry, tourism offers opportunities for development, but it has to be judged against other opportunities for development. There's no reason why tourism is necessarily better than any other, unless you happen to be in the tourism industry. And unless the tourism industry finds ways of benefiting more people, will always be vulnerable to an extractive industry coming along able to create more local employment than the tourism industry does. I'd also say that it's really important to avoid becoming a monoculture. You can't become just dependent on tourism, because then you just become a tourism attraction. And in the end, there's no reason to come and visit. The landscape is the way it is because it's forested and farmed. Those industries are really important to keeping the attraction and to keeping people in the area who are not just in tourism. You have to try to promote tourism which is appropriate to particular local communities, which means you need to engage local people in the decision making. The mantra of minimising leakages and maximising linkages is obviously relevant, but it needs to be done differently in each place, and there's no standard way of doing that. We need to encourage sustainable growth, which normally means growth that comes slowly over many years. The solution that involves just building a new hotel somewhere very often creates a hotel which will never be profitable. And there are many hotels around, certainly in England, which will never be really profitable, but which somebody thought would be a good idea. And we need to encourage local ownership. We need to encourage the ownership of tourism resources by people who live locally, who will then reinvest that money in the local economy. One of the big challenges, and I imagine it was a challenge in your project as well, is to get people to recognise that the competition is not the farmstead accommodation down the road. I mean, to be honest, the problem for Finland is as much the attractiveness of Scotland as it is the B&B down the road in Finland. Yeah, the international visitor in particular, and the domestic visitor too, have a massive range of opportunities to travel somewhere else. The challenge is to get your destination known, and for that, you have to cooperate. So cooperation is essential, I think, for attractions, for the activities, for the operators, and for the accommodation providers. You have to somehow find a way of working together to attract the tourists to come to your area and then competing to provide the tourism services when they do. So in a sense, what you're talking about is competition. You're talking about cooperation and competition and the balance between those things. It's really hard to get that right. But what it's really about is encouraging tourists to spend money on locally produced crafts, food, experiences, performances, consuming things which are produced locally. So that means you have to build on the existing livelihood strategies. You couldn't, for example, just bring in beekeeping, because beekeeping would be an attractive thing for tourists to see. The beekeeping has to be a viable agricultural activity which you then bring tourists to see as an additional source of revenue for a beekeeping business. It has to be that way around. And to make that happen, there have to be multi-stakeholder partnerships. So if you ask them the question I was asked to address, whose responsibility is it? Well, clearly, individuals looking for their main and supplementary livelihoods through businesses or through employment, the community as a whole, conservation agencies, and government. And I ran out of steam as I wrote the list, but if you think about it, the bits of government which do signage, which collect litter and which regulate, are very different parts of government. It is not just a matter of dealing with the tourism officer or the tourism ministry. It is a whole of government issue and challenge to achieve responsible tourism. To make it work, we know that you have to create employment at all skill levels, and there has to be existing capacity. There's very little point in doing it in a way if all you're going to do is import labour from somewhere else. That's not contributing to the sustainable development of the community. You really need to be finding ways of developing tourism that benefits the people who live in the community. It turns on how deep and how valuable the linkages are to the local economy and the extent to which the tourism enterprises are locally owned. Those, I think, are the three key questions which determine how much of the local economic benefit comes. And obviously it's easier to do it if it's small scale and low risk. It's much more likely to be locally owned. And that's the benefit of working with smaller businesses to do this. This is the Centre for Responsible Tourism at Manchester Metropolitan. We're very keen to work with you if there are ways in which we can find to do that. Our focus is on tourism as one part of sustainable consumption and production. But if I may, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for listening.
A few minutes for questions, if it's fine for you. Okay. Is there any questions in the audience to place? This is a unique option, possibility to place some questions concerning the speech and presentation. Okay.